What is going on, everybody? Jamie Shaw here on the Absolute Basketball Podcast. Very excited today to have Tennessee State head coach Penny Collins on the episode with me. We pretty much deep dive into Penny's career as a coach. We get into the George Floyd situation and what the country's going through right now. We also talk about what Tennessee State has, what they've gone through, the turnaround that they had last year, and what Penny has looking forward going toward next year as well with his recruiting class and development of his players and all that type of stuff moving forward. But before we get into the episode, as the normal, subscribe to the episode. If you would, go ahead and rate us 5 stars. Leave in the comments below what you enjoyed Penny saying, the favorite quote that you had from Penny within this. Please let us know below in the comments the favorite quote that you had that really helps us win the rankings of this and allows these coaches' stories, these players' stories, to get out in front of a broader audience. The more that y'all rate 5 stars, the more that y'all subscribe. So I appreciate everybody doing that. But without further ado, here is Penny Collins on the Absolute Basketball Podcast with Jamie Shaw. Thank you guys very much. What is going on, everybody? Jamie Shaw here again on the Absolute Basketball Podcast. Very excited today to have Tennessee State head coach Penny Collins on with us. Penny, how's it going?
Going good, man. Thanks for having me.
Man, I really appreciate you taking some time out. I know it's busy for you right now and all kinds of stuff going on. But first questions first, I got to ask, how did you come across the nickname Penny?
Man, this is a question I have been answering a lot lately. You know, I am from Memphis. You know, I'm a big-time Penny Hardaway fan, and I had all his shoes and his jerseys and stuff like that. So he was my favorite player. So when I moved to Nashville from Memphis, there were a couple of it was another Brian in my neighborhood. And when we go outside and play, you know, basketball, whatever we would play, everybody would say Brian. We both always kind of look, you know what I mean? So finally, this is when the little Penny commercial, it just came popular. So I used to wear my Penny Hardaway jersey all the time. So, like, as a joke, they start calling me Lil Penny the Doll. Like, you know, Chris Rock voice. Hey, Penny, you look like Lil Penny, like kind of like a little joke. And so they start calling me Lil Penny the Doll,
yeah,
you know, as a joke, but also to separate from me and Brian both having to turn our head every time. So I got the nickname Lil Penny when I was about 12 years old. And it just kind of stuck, you know, all through middle school and high school, people were calling me, my nickname was Lil Penny. And, you know, I was hooping too, but I was small. I was the smallest person on the team. Most of all the teams I played on until ninth grade, I had a massive growth spurt from like 5'8 to 6'4.
Jeez.
And yeah, it was crazy. And I played the point, and like I was a tall point guard, like Penny. So that name just kind of stuck, and it just became a little popular name around the city. So now I just kind of dropped a little, and now it's just Penny.
I got you. And then on about your playing career, you're a 4-year starter at Belmont under Coach Rick Berg, 1,100 career points. You graduated the all-time leader in assists and steals. What type – were you the type of player that you would recruit as a head coach?
Oh, absolutely. You know, came from a winning program as a high school player, played under a legendary coach, had been around basketball my entire life. Anytime you can have a chance to recruit a coach's son, who has high basketball IQ, that comes from a good family, of course, I would recruit a kid like me. That's the, and I think that's one of the reasons why Belmont's been so successful. They got a team full of guys like that that are all coming from that same, you know, championship caliber fabric. And, you know, that's how you build your culture.
In 2006, when y'all made the first tournament with Belmont as a Division I school, what was that feeling like?
Man, it was like a sigh of relief. You know, my whole goal when I got to Belmont was to help them get to the NCAA tournament and be recognized around the country as a program that you heard of and that's well-respected. And, you know, every year that we didn't get it done, it felt like just a big punch in the gut. Every time we couldn't get it done, we lose in the conference tournament. Lost to Georgia State the first year, come back next year, lose to UCF 2 years in a row, and then we hosted it at Belmont, the tournament. And then my senior year, the tournament was at East Tennessee State. Mm-hmm. And when we won, it was just like, we finally did it. And to be the first ever team to go and for it to be in my senior year, man, that was just like the ultimate send-away gift for me and our entire senior class, man. Something we always cherish and still got group text messages to this day that we were a part of. But it's good to see where that program has gone since then. But it was definitely one of the greatest feelings as a college basketball player.
There's a special bond between point guard and head coach typically on most really good teams. You played under Coach Rick Berg, who's, you know, legendary, I guess, and all that type of stuff. As a player, what did you take from him that you use as a coach now?
He was the ultimate coach when it comes to poise. It was just unbelievable. He was just unbelievable in pressure situations. I never really seen Coach sweat in a huddle. He always had us well prepared, from scouts to how he went about teaching us breaking down stuff from parts to whole. His ability to call timely sets in crucial moments that always seemed to always work. His ability to put a team together of good young men, like we talked about earlier, of high character. And there's a lot of other characters that I probably can't think of right now, but he was an unbelievable person to be around, you know, and how he went about his business. And a lot of the things that he stood for are some of the same values that we have at Tennessee State.
So after you graduated, got done at Belmont, you tried the pro route for a couple of years overseas, NBDL and stuff, and then you come back to get into coaching. What all went into that decision to kind of hang up the shoes and put on the tie?
It was a tough decision. And I really just had to follow God and kind of just lean on his will. And I had the opportunity to go back. But at that same time, I was kind of dealing with some chronic tendonitis in my knee, both knees. Not anything that required surgery, but just something that made me think, like, do I want to go through this pain again? Mm-hmm. And at the same time that I was going through that, wondering, did I want to go back and get my mind ready to go back overseas, I got offered a GA spot at Tennessee State under Sal Alexander. And initially, I told him, no, thank you. I wasn't going to do it. And he offered me that job because I worked the camp. Mm-hmm. I worked his Sal Alexander basketball camp. And when I was over there, I was just like real high energetic, you know, making my group scream and clap all loud. And, you know, we were just, you know, I made him stand straight lines. You know, he just saw that I was working well with the kids. He's like, man, you could be a great coach, man. You should come here and be a GA. And I was like, nah, coach, I'm still playing pro ball. You know what I'm saying? No, thank you. Then after just a lot of thinking, man, maybe it took me about a month and a half to come back to the decision that maybe this is what I want to do, get into coaching. And called him back, and luckily he still had a grad assistant spot open. And I took that opportunity, and it was really one of the best moments for me in my career to go to Tennessee State 14 years ago.
So you took the grad assistant job, then you eventually moved up into, you know, the ops. But outside of that, you moved to NAIA to become, you know, on the floor, on the road type of coach. What all went into that decision for you to go from the D1 bench to the NAIA bench?
Yeah, so it really – Coach Cy, you know, when you're a grad assistant, you got 2 years to get your grad assistant done. So I graduated. In my second year, I was still a grad assistant, but I was the director of basketball operations and grad assistant. Mm-hmm. So I did all the operations title and did all the operations stuff. But my time at Tennessee State was up. You know, I was done with my degree. So it was time to move on. Yeah. And I was lucky to get the assistant job at Cumberland University as an NAIA coach. And that was kind of like, I was just out searching for opportunity. I put my resume out a few different places. And when the job came open, which Lebanon, Tennessee is probably about 30 minutes from Nashville. Mm-hmm. I just was lucky to get that job. And really, it was great for me because it was my first opportunity to be a full-time assistant coach, yeah, to be able to go recruit, do scouts, be on the floor coaching. And that really shaped me to who I am.
And then in those years that you were at Cumberland University, how did you grow as a coach?
Coach Thompson, our head coach, he gave me a lot of responsibilities. He allowed me to do a lot of things in practice. He allowed me to bring in new ideas. He gave me the opportunity to do scouts and recruit the players. And I want to say that our record went from 12 wins to 18, mm-hmm, and then 18 to 22. And once I realized that I could help build a program as an assistant coach, that gave me a lot of confidence that I was ready to, you know, take it up to another level or take it up another step. But I grew tremendously, and not just from, you know, a physical standpoint as far as what I was doing, but mentally as well. Coach Thompson, you know, kind of really schooled me on what things to come, how things would be, and how I needed to react the different things in college basketball. And, you know, I really feel like I came out of there with another degree, honestly, when I left Cumberland. And anybody that's worked in AIA knows that it's not as lavish as the Division I level. You know, you can play in gyms with 100 people sometimes. You're not riding on charter buses. You know, we drove the van, 3-hour drive, get out, coach the game, hop back in, and drive back. You know, maybe not stay in the hotel. But I love my time at Cumberland University in Lebanon, Tennessee. It was very monumental for me in learning experience.
And then coming out of Cumberland University, you get your first head coaching opportunity at Columbia State. You're there for 3 seasons. The last two, 54-11 with 2 Sweet 16 appearances. One of them was an Elite Eight appearance. It seems that so many coaches these days found early success or success early in their careers in the JUCO ranks. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about JUCO basketball that kind of molds a coach to become successful later in their days?
Very similar to when you're on a small level, when you don't have as much resources, as many resources. So you're having to do more. I made a comment about being a JUCO coach. It's like dog years, like 7 years. 1 year is like 7 years, man. You learn a lot. You know, I didn't have a full-time assistant coach. I basically had 2 volunteers, basically. You know, you get really good at learning how to deal with finances because you get real creative on how you can raise money for scholarships and books and for your program. You know, it was really cool to kind of transform Columbia State to now the winning part, of course, but like to see us not really have anybody in the gym, to having packed gyms, our locker room, not having nothing in it, to, you know, going in there, painting it, you know, you really feel a sense of home. It's like when you build your own home for the first time, or you buy your first home, or you go in and renovate a home and you like make it your own. Like, I really felt that when I was at Columbia State by, you know, making my own and then building a team, because you only got guys for 2 years, you know, or 1 year. So you constantly have to keep your mind on recruiting. And usually in the 4-year schools, you may replace, you know, 2 or 3 a year. Some programs replace 8, 9 every year, but in JUCO, you're replacing 8, 9, 6, 7 every year, you know, and you only got them for 2 years. So you got to be strategic on how you're coaching them, because you don't have that much time with them. So you have to be, the mama and the daddy, Dr. Phil, psychiatrist, and the coach. So oh, yeah. It was great, man. I love my time in junior college for sure.
And then you go from running your own program, building that program up to what it was and the success that it had, back to being a D1 assistant coach, go to East Tennessee State and everything. What all kind of went into that decision to come back into the D1 route?
You know, I wanted to, that was always ultimately my goal, to go to junior college and, you know, continue to improve in my career and continue to move up the ladder. And I always wanted to do it, but I was just looking for the right opportunity with the right person. And when Coach Forbes called, that was the perfect person for me. I had been knowing him since I was at Cumberland University. Mm-hmm. And his background is very similar to mine. You know, he comes from nothing. He worked his way all the way up from the JUCO ranks all the way up to where he is now at Wake Forest, and was in no handouts. And, you know, you stand by your word. And actually, my first year at Columbia State, we played Northwest Florida. I played against him. Mm-hmm. So it was really just cool, because when we played them, I literally wrote his roster down, 1-8, 1-9, and I tried to match my team up in my second year to his roster. Like, I was trying my best, because he had just went to the national championship game.
Yeah.
2 years in a row. So I was like, man, I got to figure out, if I can get close to this, maybe we could be just as good, like, talent-wise, you know. And we did. We ended up, you know, being close. But, you know, going to work for him, man, was ideal for me, because we were the perfect fit for each other. Mm-hmm. He understood me. He understood that I didn't want to come there and just be, you know, some one-hit wonder or one-trick pony coach. I wanted to come help him win. And, you know, he gave me a lot of responsibilities, just like Coach Thompson. You know, it was really, really cool to watch him be a head coach and turning East Tennessee State into the powerhouse it became. And it's no secret to his success, you know, just hard work, roll your sleeves up, you know, get gritty, grimy, tough guys to play together. And he's got a PhD in that, man. Like, he's great to be around, man. Any stories you hear about Forbes and what kind of a person he is, and how he can light a room up and meet people he don't know right away and feel like he's been knowing forever, all that's true.
Yeah.
I've been with him a lot of different places, and I just love being around him, and just really glad that I got him as somebody to lean on.
And then, so you spent 2 years with Forbes at East Tennessee State, and you go on for 1 year at Illinois State with Dan Muller. Those two coaches in that 3 year span, what did you take away? What did you learn from those two guys?
One thing I learned right away is that there's more than one way to skin a cat. Mm-hmm. One way is not the only way to win, you know. And now I won't even just say them two guys. You know, I look back at what happened with Rick Byrd and how he handled his program versus Coach Forbes versus Dan Muller. You know, three great coaches, three different – and Coach Thompson as well, I'm sorry. Four different coaches, but four different ways to be successful. All of them were coming from – I have been won championships and, you know, won 20-something plus games. Coach Muller was just coming off a year where they were – they really should have been in the NCAA tournament. I feel like they were won like 29 games. I'm a little off of, I can't really remember exactly, but they were coming off a great year where they had just won the Valley. And so going to him, I felt like he really sharpened me as far as terms of detail. Not to say that Coach Forbes, anybody else wasn't, but I just feel like with working for Coach Muller, he really just made me, for that one season, he made me really just dive in and focused on detail. The small things matter, you know, all the way to the, you know, what color shoes the guys are going to wear tonight, to, you know, making sure everything was right on the scout, to, you know, double checking, triple checking. You know, he opened my mind up on some different things that even made me a more prepared coach. So different, definitely, than Forbes, but love him and still talk to him to this day. Just talked to him 2 days ago. You know, I always keep a good relationship with all those guys, but work for Dan Muller was something that I think was definitely needed for my career.
And so coming off of Illinois State, you get the Tennessee State job. Year one at Tennessee State, 9-21. Moving down a chair, even at 34 years old, you know, going from assistant to head coach, what was your biggest adjustment in that move?
For me, right away, it was just to understand that even though I had been a head coach before, the final decision is going to be on you, mm-hmm. you know. It's lonely at the top. That little statement people say, that's true. You know, you don't really have, other than people that are your mentors or something like that. When you make a decision, it's on you. You know, you're going to make the final decision and you got to live with it. You're not going to make everybody happy. You know, getting a job, when you're coming up the ranks, you make a lot of friends. You know, you meet a lot of people, you're networking, you're always out recruiting. You know, you just meet a lot of people. So you can't make everybody happy. You know, it's tough when you get a job and you want to hire 40 people that you're cool with, but you can only hire two, you can only hire three, and you got to do what's best for you. So that was a tough part in the beginning, you know, relationships that you've had and making tough decisions on putting the best staff together that you feel is going to help you win. And a loyal staff, guys is going to have your back, you know, through thick and thin. You got to make tough decisions and everybody's not going to always be happy. So that was probably one of the toughest parts, just kind of, you know, making the decision to make a decision, you know, that beginning part. But, you know, as far as coaching and, you know, the discipline and the X's and O's and all that, that's going to be what it is. You'll be good. You'll be bad some days. It is what it is. But I just feel like those small things of, you know, having to put your final say-so on something and sticking with it, you know, not caring about what other people think.
And then, so year one to year two was kind of a drastic turnaround. I mean, year one, obviously, as we said, 9-21. Year two, 18-15, with a postseason tournament invite. You know, obviously, we didn't get to play because of the pandemic and everything, but a great turnaround. What steps were taken, I guess, during this time frame for the program?
For me, the first year, it was kind of what it was. I think it was great for us to go through what we went through. It was a good learning experience. Got a chance to understand the league a little bit better, understand how coaches, you know, their strategies and, you know, understanding officiating, understanding other conferences, the arenas you're going to play in, and then understanding the campus even more. And then once you understand all those things, you start making little small adjustments here and there. You know, we want to hang our hat on getting high character kids that are talented to come from winning. And I felt like we did that in our first year. I feel like we tried our best to go out and do that. But at the end of the day, we made some changes on our roster to fix those things that made sense for all those things I just mentioned, mm-hmm. to match up. We needed all those things to match up. And so we ended up only bringing back two guys from that 9-win team and added, 13 new guys. And I feel like we made a really big jump in terms of how we went about our business. And then you know, our crowds changed. Mm-hmm. We went from a 900, average 900 a game to 3,500 a game. We went from last place in ESPN views to we finished first in ESPN views. So the energy, and that is not just because we were winning. It was also because our staff understood our campus. You understand what made people tick and what made people excited about coming to watch Tennessee State basketball. So we were more engaged with our students in second year. So there was just a lot of things that we did that I felt like were bigger than just us doubling our win total that went into the reason why we had so much success this year. And we're going to continue to build off that and have that same momentum moving into year three.
So last year you had 10 players who played in more than 20 games and averaged over 12 minutes a game. You shot 35% from three as a team. You averaged about 14 assists per game as well, or almost 14 assists per game as well as a team. How would you say that Tennessee State plays?
Well, we, you know, we want to be considered as a team that plays extremely hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, offensively, we want to be a team that gets a good shot down every time on offense. Defensively, we want to be a team that hounds the opposition and makes it really tough and contests every shot. Mm-hmm. And so those are some, you know, some core values that our guys know about that we talk about every day. And that's what we want to be seen as. We want that to be our identity. And it's as, like I said, even though we made a huge jump, we're nowhere near where I want my program to be from a standpoint of we have arrived, you know, we are heading in the right direction. That's what I can say about us. And even with that being said, you know, we did do some things. 11 wins is the tied for a conference. 11 wins at home tied for a record for us for the Gentry Center this year. But even with that, all those accolades, we still – it was a similar thing from first year and second year. We had a lot of injuries. You know, one of our most talented players didn't play the last five, six games of the year. We only had our full roster for one game out of 18 conference and two conference tournament games. So that's 20 games. Out of 20 games, we only had our full team once. So we just dealt with a lot of injuries this year too, where I feel like if we would have had our entire team the entire year, or just maybe more than one game, we would have had a chance to win 20-plus games. You know, if everybody can say that. But we dealt with a lot of injuries this year too. So hopefully going into next year with our roster, we'll have a little bit more depth where if we do have some injuries, we've got some guys to be able to step up.
And then kind of looking at it, are there any statistical markers that y'all strive for? That's like, if we have this many turnovers or if we have this many rebounds, whatever, you'll typically win a game or feel good about. Are there any things that y'all set forward to doing statistical markers?
Yeah, well, first of all, we turned the ball over like it was going our style this year. I mean, if we didn't turn the ball over so much this year, we may have, you know, finished in the top two or three. That's how talented our team was. But turnovers were our Achilles heel. And our goal is we want to be in the single digits in turnovers. Mm-hmm. We want to hold teams in the 30s in defensive field goal percentage. You know, we want teams to, you know, we want to keep the three-point line in the 30s. You know, we got some goals we want to hit every game. And when we hit those goals, we won, you know. So we definitely harp on that a lot.
And so this coming up year, obviously you graduated Wesley Harris, Michael Littlejohn, Jalen Washington, Emmanuel Butu. But you do return two starters with Carlos Marshall and Shakim Johnson. What will you be looking for from those two heading into next season?
Well, Carlos Marshall is a returning all-league guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he averaged around 12 points a game. So, you know, we want him to come in and strive to be a first-team all-league guy. He's got leadership skills. He's extremely talented. And he as well as he played this year, he's got so much more room to improve. So, need him to come back ready to go. Shakim Johnson, same way. You know, he averaged 9.8, but you can say he's a fringe double figure guy, but he needs to be in double figures every game. He needs to be, you know, make that jump to, you know, consistently every night being a consistent guy. He had games, if you look at his game logs, where he go 18-7 or, you know, 19-10 or something, and then come back and go 6-4. So we need him to be more consistent. And, you know, he's a JUCO transfer. So for a JUCO guy to come in and average double figures for us in year one, that's great for him. So coming in year two, we expect a lot more. And then the third guy, which is, as you look at those game logs, who's a part-time starter, is our point guard, Mark Freeman. Mm-hmm. who's got a chance to be, you know, one of the most talented point guards in the league. I expect him to make a huge jump going into his sophomore year. So with those three guys, you know, I think that's a lot of leadership that's going to come from those three. But it's also very encouraging, you know, going from year one to year two, we only had two guys returning, and now we have nine. So I'm encouraged, you know, that, you know, with nine guys coming back, you know, we won't have to spend as much time. Those guys can lead and get us moving in the right direction a little quicker.
And in this class coming in, you have Georgia State transfer Josh Linder. You have two JUCO transfers with Shaquan Barrett and Yusuf Muhammad, and then two high school players with Evan Joyner and Marcus Fitzgerald. What were you trying to do heading in with this class?
So we wanted to address the problems that we had. And, you know, the turnover problem was something that was important for me to address. Whenever you bring in guys back that have been through it, they're going to all get better, you know. But we wanted to get some guards that could handle pressure and can get in the paint and finish through contact and get in the paint and kick and make good decisions. And we feel like we addressed that big time with Marcus Fitzgerald, who's a number one point guard in the state of Tennessee, and Shaquan Barrett, who is a Northwest Florida transfer who didn't have the year statistically that he wanted to have or the win-loss year, but he's one of the most talented players in the country. He's coming in with a lot of badges on his chest from playing at Tulane University and being one of the top players in Canada in his age group. So Shaquan should have a really good impact right away. He brings a guard that has experience, has played on the collegiate level already. He's got size, a 6'5", so we're really excited about him. And then with losing Wesley Harris and Jalen Washington are both over 6'7", Wesley 6'9", and Jalen Washington 6'9", but one thing they both could do, they could really stretch the defense. Mm-hmm. Yusuf Muhammad is one of the top JUCO players in the country. North Idaho, I think they went something like 30-something and one, or, you know, he's lost like four games in 2 years.
Yeah.
And he'll fit the bill to that same type of guy with length. He's 6'10". He can shoot the three. He can put it on the floor. And extremely talented. So we addressed that problem by losing both of those guys. And then losing Emmanuel Igbuda, we felt like Josh Linder, coming in with NCAA term experience, 6'9". I recruited him out of high school, so I already had a relationship with him. And I feel like he was on his way to having a really good career. You know, he had a good season this year for Georgia State, averaging what, 5-4 or something like that. So naturally, in 15 minutes a game. So naturally, if he was to, you know, go up to 20 something minutes, 25 minutes, he'd be, you know, maybe a fringe double figure guy for Georgia State. So it didn't work out for him. And me and Coach Linnery had a long talk about Josh, and it wasn't, he didn't get pushed out or anything like that. You know, it was just a really good opportunity for him to come here and have a bigger role. So I'm excited, really excited about our entire class. And then Evan Joyner is the one that many people in my region may not know about him. In Tennessee and Georgia may not know about him, but he may end up being the guy that people are surprised that he ended up at Tennessee State. I don't like putting this kind of pressure on anybody, but he could play in the NBA one day. He could be the guy we look up and say, see a 6'8 wing, who's put on, by that time, put on 15, 20 pounds, because he has every skill set you need. He can shoot it. He can score at all three levels. He can defend. He's a pogo stick. He can jump out of the gym. And he's an amazing kid, you know, coming in with 3.9 GPA. And his daddy is he's a coach's son. You know, his dad coached college basketball and played college basketball. And anytime, he's kind of like myself, anytime you can get a guy like that in your program, you're going to take them every time. So I'm very excited about Evan Joyner's potential.
Absolutely. And then, so you're going into year three at your program. You played under Rick Berg, who has a clear identity with what he did. Steve Forbes has a clear identity you coach with there, Dan Muller and stuff. What type of identity going into year three are you trying to create here at Tennessee State?
I want us to be a team that's revered like those teams you just named. When you say East Tennessee State, you know you're going in there and you got a game on your hands. Mm-hmm. When you play Belmont, you know you're going to play against a well-disciplined team that moves the ball and shoots the three and extremely disciplined. And the same with Illinois State. You know you're going into a game where they're going to be well-prepared and they're going to play the right way. You know, in Tennessee State, we want that same feel. We want that same people talking about us the same type of way where, oh, you're going to put Tennessee State on your schedule, you better be ready for a game. Those guys are going to play extremely hard. They're going to play together. They're going to play the right way. They're going to move the ball, and they're going to guard the hell out of you. So I want us to be on that path where people are talking like that about us. I don't know if we're there yet, but I do know that there's another level of respect for TSU right now that that when we play them, when we play teams, they know it's not going to just be an easy win.
These last two or three months, we've been obviously in quarantine. You haven't been able to have your hands on the players, and you know they've been trying to do schooling away and all that type of stuff. How have you stayed engaged with your team over these last two or three months, both you know from an academic standpoint, from a basketball standpoint, from a just a development as a man standpoint? How have you stayed engaged with the team over these last couple months?
Yeah, we have constant conversations with our guys. Once a week, we have Zoom meetings every Tuesday. So actually today, in about a couple of hours, we're going to meet with our guys, and we bring different people in to speak with them. Mm-hmm. We let those guys get engaged with each other, break them off in Zoom groups. And, you know, obviously we'll call guys individually and check on them, make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do, you know, staying out of trouble, staying focused on what's going on. Because obviously being back at home, it's easy to kind of just chill and not do anything. And then just kind of sitting on G, staying on O, because at any moment when we get that phone call, we might be back ready to work. So make sure guys are staying in shape. But yeah, we spend a lot of time with our guys when they're here. And right now, you know, that once a week Zoom call is really therapeutic for everybody, just to kind of see everybody smile and have a good talk. And, right now we're doing like a four week session with a guy named Jason Wells, who's kind of like just getting our minds wrapped around, you know, all being on one page. So it's definitely a different time, but you know, it's probably well needed for everybody.
And then I guess campuses and schools are easing back into place, people coming back on campus and all that kind of stuff. What plan do y'all have in place for the Tennessee State basketball program?
Well, we're planning to hopefully get back together in the end of this month, end of June, early July. And hopefully we can get back to some type of voluntary workout or if the school permits it for us to actually get to our summer access and actually be able to practice and work the guys out and lift them and all that good stuff. So we still don't know yet, but we're hoping at the end of this month we can get back to work.
We have a lot going on in our country now with the, you know, along with the COVID-19, but also the recent murder of George Floyd in Minnesota. What are your reactions to what all is going on today?
Well, you know, I've seen it on social media a lot. And I think it's so true when you say that we're dealing with two diseases in the country right now, you know, COVID-19 and racism. The thing that happened with George Floyd, it's something that you can't even really put into words. It's probably one of the most disturbing moments of my life to see a 9-minute murder. And it's really, I don't want to say it's a good thing, but it's good to see a lot of people are coming together for one common cause that has been going on for way too long. The death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery have really sparked a new conversation throughout the world. And I'm glad to see, you know, my brothers and sisters, my white brothers and sisters, really step up to the plate, man, to protest, and to see that this is one of the first protests in the world, in the history of mankind, to go on in every state and, you know, 20 plus countries, and for as long as it's going on, you know, I expect to see some change. But I am encouraged that everybody is understanding how important it is to be one, and how important it is to fight right versus wrong. So, you know, got to continue on this path and continue to put action towards it.
And then what do you talking about with your team? How are y'all as a team coming together and talking about this, and what are they taking from it and all that?
Immediately after it happened, we got on a Zoom call. You know, like I said, we do every Tuesday, but I want to say when it's all went down, I got my guys on the Zoom call like right away. It might have been like a Friday. I just randomly called my ops guy and said, let's get on a Zoom with the guys. And I just kind of wanted to hear them out and let them talk, and told them how I felt about it. And I think that's the biggest thing you can do for your guys is listen. Listen to them, listen to their struggles, let them tell their stories. And then you want to educate them on the history of what's going on. This is not a one-time thing, and understand the magnitude of the situation, and understand that they're angry, and be sympathetic to that. But listening is the key. Listening is the key. And after I talked to them and we had our whole staff on Zoom, it's funny because I thought even as a black man, I thought that answered all of our problems. Like our guys are fine. We're good. I'm glad we talked about it. But it didn't. You know, as soon as we got off the phone, I would get phone calls from two or three different guys saying, Coach, I got this question. Coach, I got this question. And concern. It wasn't like no five-minute conversation. These are 30, 45-minute conversations with kids that just want to talk and understand why. And so after that, after those conversations, I had to bring in a guy to talk to him. You know, I wanted them to hear from somebody else because it's kind of like that whole age thing of, you know, you don't want to listen to your dad. You know, you ain't going to talk to your dad, you know. But when coach tell you, you listen to the coach. You know, I got a seven-year-old son. When I go outside with him, he won't listen to me basketball. When he goes with his little seven-year-old team, but his coach tell him the same thing, he'd be ready to run through the wall with it. But with this situation, I brought in an outside source, and they just – yeah, they were on the phone an hour and a half, 2 hours, just talking about what's going on in the world. And I thought it was very healthy for them to hear from somebody else about how things are going. And I would encourage any coach that has a team to bring in an outside source to let your team talk to them about it. African-American person, obviously, and let them, you know, give their side of the story and let your players vent to them, because there might be some band-aids that need to get pulled open that they won't pull open in front of you. So, and those are the things, some of the things we're doing. And I encourage my guys to protest the right way. And if they have a message they want to get across, to feel free to run it by me and by all means post it on social media. But, you know, when our guys do get back, we're going to put some things in place. And one of the things we're working on right now is we're getting all of our guys registered to vote. Mm-hmm. We want all of our guys to vote. It's very important that, you know, guys understand the importance of your vote. You know, every vote does truly count. And a lot of kids, especially African American people, don't believe that their vote will count. But that's why a lot of them don't even vote. So we have to encourage our young African American students, and really not just African American students, all athletes, period. You know, to go out and vote and do the right thing. So I made it a point for myself to make sure every single one of my players is going to be registered to vote, and we're currently working on that right now online before they even get back to campus.
And then moving forward, what steps do you think need or would you like to see kind of be taken from here?
You're talking about in the world? Mm-hmm. Off the rip, there needs to be an education of what's going on, like the history, mm-hmm. and the way people think. Racism is not, you're not born into it, you're taught it. My son is 7 years old and doesn't understand that at all. He doesn't know what's going on. He has never seen a color. He has friends of all different races, and they go play and have fun. Well, at some point, one of the other times, somebody's taught a certain way. So we need to start with that. We need to understand that, you know, drive out hate. You know, we gotta, you know, lead with love. The next step would be police reform. I think police officers have to take some new ways of how they go about, you know, dealing with apprehending somebody that they deem did something wrong. You know, chastising needs to be taken completely out of policing. You know, I can't tell you how many times that I've been pulled over for something simple, seatbelt, license, a light being out, or, you know, allegedly speeding or running a stop sign, and you just want the simple, give me a ticket or 1, 2, 3, but it's always some type of little smart chastising comment that if you're not a well-balanced person or a mild person, it turns into an argument. Argument turns into an arrest. Sometimes some arrest turns into you die, or you shot, you killed, or choked out, or beat up, or spend a night in jail. So there's just a lot of things, man. I really do feel like a lot of police officers that have been in these situations are in them because of A, racism, or B, foolish pride, to where you just can't let it go. You know, maybe they haven't had power before in a situation where they have the power. And, you know, I would say this, because I never said this on a podcast, that in the early days, in the civil rights movement, a lot of African Americans would get together at people's houses, mm-hmm. and they would do fake run-throughs of the sit-ins that they were going to do the next day. And in those fake run-throughs, they would have each other sit down at tables, and they would pour milk on each other and spit on each other and things of that nature. Just try to aggravate each other and chastise each other. And the people that couldn't handle it, the one to get up and fight, and react in a certain way. They didn't let them do the sit-ins. Mm-hmm. You had to just sit there and take it. A dog biting on you, somebody spitting in your face, pouring milk on you, whatever, embarrassing you. You had to sit there and take it if you was going to be a part of sit-ins. So it took a really mentally tough person to be a part of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And if we were doing that as the oppressors, people that are in the position to be police officers should be going through that same type of training. So that when you're out in the field and a person, whether it be white, black, or brown, say something crazy to you, you know, whatever, do something crazy to you, if you're going to react by shooting them or tasing them or choking them to death, then you can't be a police officer. You know what I'm saying? It's that same, it's the same concept. And I think that goes into police reform. You know, I don't believe that they teach the police officers those kind of training techniques. And I think that would be a huge step in the right direction on how a lot of these problems that we're having with police brutality has been, they have been all started by, you know, the police officer having a bad reaction to a situation. You know what I'm saying? So I do believe that would go a long way. And then understanding the importance of voting. We have to get out and vote. We have to be, I remember when Obama was voted in, elected as the president. I remember in our community how big it was to vote. Mm-hmm. And how t-shirts, everybody had these please go vote t-shirts, and every artist and celebrity was talking about how important it was to vote. And then in the last couple of elections, it's kind of just died down. And now that it's died down, you've seen a big loss in the amount of votes that people are voting. It's just not as important, and for whatever reason. So I think that needs to be brought up too. And you know, and I'm not making a judgment on who's a good president and who's not a good president. But my point is that people need to go out and vote. You know, I don't get into politics that much, but I do know people need to vote.
No, absolutely. I think you brought up some incredible points and all that too. And it's good to see that all this stuff coming to light and people reacting, you know, in a manner and sustaining that reaction and still continuing to go forward and speak up and do things. It's been nice to see. Long time coming for sure.
Yeah, no doubt.
And kind of here to wrap things up, you know, I wanted to kind of swing it back over to Tennessee State basketball, ask you, what is it that we can expect on the floor next season from the Tennessee State basketball program?
Ultimately, our goal is to compete for OVC championship. I believe this team going into year three is going to be well-equipped in every position. We're going to have depth. For the first time, we're going to have experience of guys that have actually been, have some success mm-hmm. in the OVC. Our guys believe that they can win. The confidence level should be extremely high. And ultimately, we want Tennessee State to be, you know, ranked in the country. We want to be, you know, one of the first HBCUs ranked in the country. We want our guys to go into every game believing that we know we're going to win. Mm-hmm. You know, the teams in our league that have been winning, Belmont and Murray State, they have an aura about them. When you play against them, you can tell those guys just believe they're going to win. Even if they get down 10 or down 6 or whatever, they're going to stay the course, and they just believe it. And we want our guys to have that same type of swagger. That we are a championship-caliber team. We got a championship-caliber coach and championship-caliber fans. And so we're headed in that direction. I'm really excited about, you know, about Tennessee State and the direction we're headed in. And I just believe that if people continue to talk about and write about some of the great things that our league is doing, mm-hmm. That you'll continue to see a better, more talent continue to come through the league, and we're just in a really good place right now.
Absolutely, Penny. I appreciate you coming on, taking some time. It's been awesome to see what you've done, and I can't wait to see what the future has in store. I'm sure it's going to be a lot of success and a lot of good times. So I can't wait to see what the future has for you coming down the pipeline.
Yes, sir, man. Thanks for having me on again.
Absolutely. Guys, thank you all very much for tuning in on the Absolute Basketball Podcast. For Penny Collins, I'm Jamie Shaw, and we'll see you next time.